Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we react to the news that Chelsea have sacked their manager Thomas Tuchel and predict Graham Potter replacing him in the role. What will Potter bring to Stamford Bridge? And was it too soon to dismiss Tuchel after winning the Champions League? Speaking of which, a poor result this week for Liverpool in the competition. We'll also speak about how Celtic and Rangers got on. Spurs and Manchester City prepared to meet in the Premier League this weekend. And we'll discuss the start of the new WSL season. All that and more on this episode of The Game. Hello and welcome back to The Game Podcast. Hope you're all well. I'm Hugh Woozencroft. I'm alongside Gregor Robertson. Tony Cascarino, the former Chelsea striker, is here, as is Molly Hudson. Tony, we've got to start by saying congratulations to you. Joyeux anniversaire. Happy 60th. That's why you weren't with us on Monday. Did you have a good time enjoying yourself celebrating?
Fantastic. I went to Northern France, Le Touquet, which is beautiful, played golf, 15 of us. I won the golf as well, which made it even
better.
They let you in,
Tony.
Yes, but I had a really good time. Great fun, good food. Yeah, absolute brilliant journey, yeah. Not the 60, getting to 60, but the last weekend.
Fantastic. Glad you enjoyed yourself. We missed you. So happy that you're back, because we have to discuss your former club. This is where we start. Chelsea sacking Thomas Tuchel. It was the new owner's 100th day in charge after their third defeat of the season. That came in the Champions League against Dinamo Zagreb. But a lot of people left asking if it was too soon. Thomas Tuchel won 3 trophies during his 20 months in charge, including the Champions League, of course. A club statement, though, said the owners believed it was the right time to bring in a new head coach. Chelsea, currently 6th in the Premier League, 3 wins, 1 draw and 2 defeats so far. Also only had 3 wins in 9 in all competitions at the back end of last season. But having spent over £250 million this summer on players like Sterling, Aubameyang, Fofana, Koulibaly and Cucurella, like I said, was it too soon, Tony?
Was I surprised? Not really. I think, you know, wealthy owners who invest so much, and I saw them against Brentford at Stamford Bridge when they lost 4-1. Saw them against Arsenal at Stamford Bridge when they lost 4-2. Everton away wasn't particularly great. The Leeds performance this year, you know, they're all games, you know, relatively in a short period from where we are today. And I thought, after the way he spoke about his team, because he questioned his team's desire and hunger, and I thought, well, that's not an honest assessment of your team, because I wouldn't accuse Chelsea players of, you know, lacking the desire and motivation to play a football game. I would have said there was a lot wrong. It wasn't that. So, no, I wasn't that surprised. I know it made major news when it broke and everyone seemed to be so shocked. But, you know, there's something... Owners act very different from what we say is the normal reaction, that they tend to be a bit more decisive when they think they need to make change. They make it pretty quickly, and especially at big football clubs, you.
Okay, Gregor, what was your reaction to it?
I was definitely surprised. I think with the win, you kind of you pick the bones out of it a little bit more. It does become, you know, almost something that both parties probably will walk away from and think, you know, it's probably the right decision almost. Because Tuchel was starting to be a real kind of cantankerous, miserable. And as Tony was saying, you know, he was really digging out his players quite often, quite frequently. And, you know, sometimes it was deserved and sometimes, as Tony said, maybe not. And, you know that's not a good, that's a bit of a slippery slope as well. So, I don't know, if you just kind of look at, I think the owners, the new owners of the club have like acted like they've got a shiny new train set and they spent all summer going around looking for gleaming new parts and they're giddy with excitement and they've all the while they've had a misery guts in the dugout and a misery guts in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And every time a microphone's put in front of him, he's been a misery guts. And I think that he's kind of bummed them out a bit, really. And that's it.
That's,
I know,
fair.
That sounds very simple, but I think they are really excited about buying a club of the size of Chelsea. They've got a couple of billion pounds worth of blank cheques burning a hole in their pocket. They've got, Tuchel, on the other hand, has got to explain to them why it's not a good idea to sign Ronaldo. I think it was a bit of a clash. Tuchel's so used to having people with expertise above him. All the people he'd worked with at the football club have left, and suddenly he's got to explain, he's got to play a big part in recruitment and explain to these, giddy Yanks why Ronaldo's not a good idea.
But don't you feel for him because of that?
I do a little bit. I think it's, you've got to look at his 18 months. It's been remarkable. His first 6 months were incredible in that he won the Champions League. He turned a pretty shambolic defence into the best in Europe. He's reached 3 cup finals. And then Russia invaded Ukraine and suddenly he's been asked questions about geopolitics and he's the face of Chelsea, a frozen football club. And then there's an interminable takeover saga and it's just going on and on and on and on. And then the guys who come in don't really have any expertise and he's asked to do more jobs than just being the head coach. Add to that, I think he's had some problems going on in his personal life in the background since he moved to London. I honestly think he'll probably walk away from this and go, this isn't the worst thing that's happening to me.
I think this is a fair question as well. What do you think Roman would have done if he'd have been still in charge? Would you have been surprised if he'd have sacked him?
Well, this is the thing. I said at the end of last season, had Roman Abramovich been in charge, he would have got sacked in the summer. But obviously his response would be, we wouldn't have had such poor results at the end of last season had Roman Abramovich been in charge and the club, as Gregor pointed out, hadn't had assets frozen and we didn't have the geopolitical situation. So it's one that it's so hard to answer. What would you say, Tony?
I think very likely, yeah. I mean, Roman, I think he quite openly, or his team openly admitted when Jose came back from the second time that they held on as long as they could, but wanted to sack him earlier and felt it was a mistake. And I think they ended up when they lost against Leicester and it was about November time, Roman Abramovich decided to pull the trigger. Now, he's done it way quicker to other managers. So it's a tough one. And Gregor is absolutely spot on. You have to give him the whole length of his time at Chelsea, what he achieved. But there, and just adding to what Gregor said, sometimes there's nothing worse than having a miserable manager going in, day out of, just feeling a negative vibe. And you need a relationship with your team and your colleagues. And I didn't feel that was very good.
Molly, what's your reaction to everything going on at Chelsea and Thomas Tuchel sacking? Was it fair or was it too soon?
I think, kind of echoing what Tony said, really, I wasn't all that surprised and I don't imagine Thomas Tuchel was either. I think what maybe surprised me is the timing because, Tom Roddy wrote a fantastic piece on this for the Times about the fact that the writing was kind of on the wall from sort of pre-season onwards. It was quite clear that Tuchel was close to the likes of Petr Cech, Marina Granovskaya, and then they left and obviously his role changed. So there was numerous things that have kind of gone on over the summer, as Gregor mentioned, everything that happened with Roman as well, that have kind of contributed to this. But I just feel a bit sorry for whoever does come in and, whether it's going to be Graham Potter, because the recruitment was still very much Tuchel's involvement in it because of the way his role changed. And someone like Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang coming into the club so recently, I think that's the bit of it that surprised me, the kind of lack of joined-up thinking. It was logical, perhaps, you could argue, to get rid of Tuchel for all of the reasons that we've discussed. But then it wasn't logical to continue down the same road with the signings that they've made, because then if somebody like Potter does come in, it suddenly becomes a much more difficult task than if they had pulled that trigger earlier on and he had himself more of a say in what went forwards, or they just held off a little bit and then waited arguably until January to make some of these bigger moves with a new manager at the helm. But it was, I think Gregor said that, you know, they had that money burning in their pocket, didn't they? And I think it is a little bit of inexperience, maybe just the way they've gone about it. But then I suppose we've seen plenty of owners across the Premier League that have made seemingly equally baffling decisions in terms of recruitment and then getting rid of the manager. So I suppose in that sense, the new Chelsea ownership are just following in the footsteps of plenty of other owners that have a lot of money and a lot of say and maybe make some questionable decisions based on that.
Okay, we've had our say. Let's hear from the man himself. You mentioned him a few moments ago there, Molly. Tom Roddy doing some great writing on this in The Times, so check it out on The Times app right now. But I did manage to speak to him late last night. He's had a very, very busy day. And asked him, started by asking him just how he'd found out the news of Thomas Tuchel sacking.
Well, how I found out was stepping off the plane from Heathrow after coming back from Zagreb, where there'd been that humbling defeat to a club that was so, you know, really essentially minnows in the Champions League for that kind of competition. And of course, your immediate reaction is to think, wow, was it that bad? But Heathrow arrivals, the Cafe Nero you'll find there, became my office for the next 5 hours. And then I started making calls and you discovered this had actually been a plan, part of the plan long before yesterday. And actually, bizarrely in a way, especially when you consider the transfer window that they've just had and Thomas Tuchel's control on that. I mean, he'd been a significant part of the recruitment this summer. It actually, the small cracks began to appear. I think it was July 24th, it would be the date, which was in Orlando when Chelsea were playing Arsenal and of course got thumped right at the end of the pre-season. And it was the way that Tuchel reacted to that game. It made Boehly and the rest of the Chelsea hierarchy start to think perhaps he's not the guy that we want to be taking us forward. And of course, now we're at the stage very quickly where Graham Potter has emerged as the favourite. And my understanding is tonight is that he's in advanced talks and essentially it's his job if he wants it. There's a release clause that they're willing to pay, which is about £15 million that includes his three members of his backroom staff. So we're really at the stage where it might even be a surprise if he wasn't on the touchline at Fulham on Saturday.
Right, you've taken me right from the start of the story till the end there. I only asked you how you found out, Tom Roddy. I mean, very thorough.
It's been one of those days.
Listen, let's go to a little bit of the building blocks on the way, because I'll take you back to you saying the Chelsea hierarchy realising that Thomas Tuchel might not be the man to take them forward. We could look back at results from the end of last season. That might be a contributing factor. I'm not personally sure he handled the situation well with all of the Roman Abramovich situation with the UK government, the freezing of assets, etc. I felt there were some excuses during that period of time for some of the results. Do you think that weighed on the mind of the new Chelsea owner, some of the performances from last season? Or, as many people are saying, was it really soon in the season, especially with all the new signings, to be dismissing your boss?
What was quite interesting, Hugh, is comparing that period with the sanctions with Tuchel to this period where he has looked very stressed and he's been very emotional and unpredictable and quite prickly in the past. Well, ever since the beginning of the pre-season tour, really, in LA. And you compare that to when he was in charge and of a team that had sanctions placed on them. They were trying to work out whether they were going to be driving to games across Europe or being able to pay the players. And at that moment, he was a picture of calmness, which when you compare it to now is quite remarkable. And actually, I think that reflects the real reason in what's happened here. And that is this, that Tuchel was so comfortable and so happy in the old regime. He spoke about the small group. It was him, Marina Granovskaya and Petr Cech. They were the allies who worked together and basically ran Chelsea during the time that Tuchel was there. And of course, this summer, Granovskaya leaves, is essentially forced out. Cech decides to go, and he loses those pillars of support, and he has to work with a far bigger group with a bigger role that he didn't want to have. And it just feels that Tuchel was really quite married to that old regime and was not on board with this one.
Yeah, I got to ask questions about Todd Bowley. What do we say? I don't usually call him the owner of Chelsea because he's not actually the majority shareholder, but he's had such a huge influence at the club clearly since becoming the interim sporting director, and he managed to get some big names in the club, spent a hell of a lot of money as well, and has immediately got rid of the manager, a Champions League winning manager at the club, no less. So what do you make of this decision, and what do we learn about him so far as the influence rather he's got over the club?
What we've learned from this decision is a little bit of a continuation of what we've learned over this summer, really, and that's that there's no time to waste. These guys take decisions immediately and are very decisive. Tuchel gone, the players they signed this summer. But with Bowley's kind of role in all of this, even Tuchel was kind of explaining how difficult it was for them all because they were thrown into this situation where none of them had been involved in the football transfer business before. They've worked together in the sports world with the LA Dodgers, but never this. They've had to find their feet, and they are having to find their feet very, very quickly. But there was always the plan to get to 100 days and evaluate where the things that have gone right and the things that have gone wrong. And in the things that have gone wrong bracket, there was a few things. The Rafinha transfer was one of them, or the lack of a Rafinha transfer was one of them. But the standout was Tuchel and the relationship with Tuchel and the way that deteriorated over the past few weeks and months, and they decided to bring it to an end. But one thing I'd say as well, Hugh, is that Potter feels like a little bit of a gamble to me, in a way. I get it. It makes sense because he is one of the brightest coaches around and promising as well in his excellent style of play. And you can see him being a great coach for many years to come. And you can see it happening potentially at Chelsea. It's just that it's not proven at the moment. He's not a proven top level manager in Champions League, and it's very different managing characters at Brighton and Hove Albion and Swansea City and Ostersunds to managing the guys that he's going to find at Chelsea.
Is he the right fit finally, Tom, though? I mean, I just find it, you know, from everything we know about Graham Potter and everything we know about Chelsea and what we've seen so far under Todd Bowley, it just, does it fit? I mean, does he get the time, in your opinion, that he would need to really develop this Chelsea team and be a great success? Is it a good decision?
Yes. Right now, yes. And part of the reason I'm saying that is because everything I'm hearing is this point of stressing. We are not continuing the previous era at Chelsea where it was very trigger happy and there was a revolving door of managers and they were seen as the removable object, weren't they? This appointment is one that they want to be long term. This Bowley and the hierarchy, they admire clubs like Man City and Liverpool. And part of that is the dynasties that Klopp and Guardiola have created there. And that's what they want to do at Chelsea. And of course, you could say that most Premier League clubs, most clubs would want to do that. They don't want to be hiring and firing all the time. But it says something that they're going for someone who has a history of doing that. He did it at Ostersunds and is doing it at Brighton, and he's a safe pair of hands in terms of a reliable progression. That's what his career has shown so far. I would be fascinated to see the list of controversies that have surrounded Graham Potter's career, because it wouldn't take long to get through them, because there really aren't ever any. I was thinking about the comparison to Tuchel, where, you know, the handshake at the end of the Tottenham game. Graham Potter would never, ever do that.
And this is why I've got question marks over whether he can handle Chelsea as a football club. But we'll come on to that with Tony Cascarino and the guys next. Tom Roddy, thank you for joining us on the game. Great information. Appreciate it. Tom Roddy there. I think casting our eyes forward a little bit then as to who might be in the dugout next for Chelsea. And I think it is just about agreed as we talk here on Thursday morning that the Brighton boss, Graham Potter, will become the new manager of Chelsea, an English manager in the Champions League, no less. He led Brighton to a record high finish of ninth in the Premier League last season. Tony, I want to start by asking you if you think he is ready for a job the magnitude of Chelsea.
Well, that's a completely different challenge than managing Brighton, which is pretty obvious. Look, he's been a pragmatic manager and the style of play. This year, they've been slightly more free scoring, but if you take their last two seasons, 42 goals and 40, you know, in their two campaigns. And I've watched Brighton numerous times and have always felt that, yeah, exactly, really, you know, to be a team that stays up and gets mid-table is an incredible achievement. And they seem a more attack-minded team this year. So he seems flavour of the month. And don't get me wrong, I love to see people given opportunities that normally doesn't happen for them. But it's a different challenge completely going to Chelsea Football Club. And expectation to be challenging on every front, dealing with much bigger players. And the egos of bigger players, because that is a challenge in itself. There is a part of me that I want to give every opportunity of being successful. But I think it's a big jump going from Brighton to Chelsea.
I agree that, you know, the last bit that Tony said there about, you know, he's never dealt with bona fide stars. Chelsea players know as well as any players that managers are far more expendable than they are. So if they don't, you know, he has to get the buy-in. We speak about that quite frequently. And, you know, he has done it, but he's done it with a team in Ostersunds and sort of, you know, rugged Sweden, and getting them to perform Swan Lake and things like that. It's a different, it's a very different thing to Chelsea. And so is Brighton. I want to see him given this chance and I want to see him succeed. Yeah. And That's just my kind of instant reaction. It's obvious there's a kind of an understandable kind of feeling that it might not make a happy marriage because it's Chelsea and it's like it's sort of a clash. He's all about culture, the human touch, a project, you know, all those kind of human values. Being a head coach, even at Brighton, where he was just one part of a well functioning sort of structure and machine. Chelsea are just the antithesis to all of that. Their money bags, their ego, their success here now. So you think instantly that doesn't really make a good marriage, but we also don't really know what the Bowley Clear Lake ownership envisage for Chelsea. We you know, that's what Chelsea have been, and all that we've seen so far under them in this short period sort of is kind of falling on from the old Chelsea, same old Chelsea. But we don't know what they want them to be. They might want to give someone 5 years and, you know, say build a dynasty. But all the things about winning here and now will not change, no matter whether they want that to happen or not. He's going to have to win to some extent, at least, to be given the time to succeed. I just hope he is given that time.
You imagine the end of the season and Chelsea didn't make the Champions League. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very likely that he wouldn't be the manager thereafter. So It's really difficult. Big clubs, and I played for a few of them in my career, it's a completely different mentality. and about having to be successful. You know, you're a Man United fan. You've seen change. The difference between, say, Fergie, what he achieved, he was a winner in Scotland, but the difference was that Fergie came with a very attack-minded game style that he produced year after year, and all his players were, you know, great, just effectively technical, brilliantly fast-forward, you know, just an attacking team. Now, Graham Potter doesn't design his teams like that. He's very much a counter-attack and does it very well. But if you're not being successful and you're playing quite a mundane style at times, I've come away from Brighton thinking, oh, I don't know if I could watch these every week. I appreciate they're really, really good at certain things in the game with their formation, their setup. But I think, oh, I don't know if
I see Brighton as, I always describe them as like a two-touch football team. Like they're so neat. They're so nice to watch. They're so pretty on the eye. It doesn't always go somewhere and it doesn't always lead to a goal, yeah. Right? It's a well-coached football team. Molly, do you think, just going back to sort of what Gregor mentioned there, whether this would be a good relationship? Does Graham Potter match Chelsea? Is it the right club for him? What do you think?
Well, I just want to pick up on something you said there, actually, about, you know, it doesn't always have that outcome. And I watched quite a lot of Brighton last season, went to a few games at the Amex, and it's strange how much timing plays a part in football, because if you'd had this conversation a year ago, quite a few of the Brighton fans actually were getting a bit frustrated with watching that style of football, which was very nice. And obviously Potter has always been hugely respected across the league as a very good manager. But as a fan of Brighton, it was quite frustrating that they didn't manage to score that much. There'd be games where you'd go and watch them, and as Tony says, I have to agree, you'd think, oh, I'm going to watch this same... You kind of knew, it's very predictable. You knew what you were getting with Brighton, the way they played. And it's probably taken until the back end of last season, the start of this season, to really break through and to get maybe the results that Brighton deserved for their performances, which they didn't always get. You know, they were at some points in that relegation battle, weren't they? And I think it's quite interesting that this job has come up at this particular time when Potter's stocks are on the rise, I suppose. And I think that did that play a part in getting rid of Tuchel? Did they look that far forward? I'm not sure they did. But I think it's very interesting in terms of whether Chelsea will be used to that style. I remember periods under Frank Lampard when the Stamford Bridge crowd kind of really struggled to watch the football, and they had like a bad run of results at Stamford Bridge, and they did get on their back quite quickly. They're used to winning games, and I think that's what will be really interesting. Those expectations, both as a manager in terms of what he will need to do in the background in terms of communicating with the ownership, which is a very different setup to Brighton, but also the expectations of the club in terms of winning, in terms of, you know, as Gregor said, it's with the most respect to the world, very different to do that at a top-end Premier League club than it is what he has experienced so far. So I think it'll be interesting to see if it has been a case of perfect timing, that his stocks are on the rise and he's going to go on and kind of accelerate his development as a coach at Chelsea, or if this is almost what he's going through at Brighton, the result of the perfect project, I suppose, that's coming to fruition. And he's going to obviously be starting again from scratch at Chelsea, which is a very different proposition.
The one thing I would say about his football is that it creates chances. Like, Brighton are always pretty high up in the XG tables, and I know, you know, you've got to take it sometimes with a pinch of salt, and Chelsea can miss chances too. But his football dominated possession and created goal-scoring opportunities. They just very often didn't have anyone to put them away. So that's, you know, I know what you're saying about his football, and but I think he's going to be taking such a step up in the quality of his player, the quality of players at his disposal, that it's quite exciting actually to see where it can go from here if he's given that opportunity.
Interesting. I agree with Gregor, is because, like, as a player, when you have to go up to another level, and there's players, players we could list, a huge list of them, and go, well, they've gone from League Two to League One, got to the Premier League and continue to do really well. Same for a coach.
Yeah, you know? No, it's been going through my head. Look, this is a very different level. Chris Wilder and Alan Nil, they were my managers at my coaches, sorry, at Northampton Town in League Two. And I remember speaking to them after they went to Sheffield United, and they did a lot of the same stuff that they did with us, but they were doing it with better players, and they got to the Premier League, and it was like, these guys can sort of enact our ideas.
Yeah.
Don't want to be cold about it, but you always couldn't.
Yeah.
And they weren't just saying that just to me, but that's the truth of it. You know, managers can improve by the people around them as much as a player improved on the pitch by the players around them.
Yeah. The one thing that I would say, though, I think the style of football with the quality of player in the Chelsea squad, if they're good to watch, like Brighton are good to watch, they will get results, because Brighton currently get results and they have got a lot of big results against high quality teams and managers. The only thing that I would say is, when I was thinking about Graham Potter, when I was thinking about going into a club like Chelsea, a team like Chelsea, everything extra that comes with that, you know, it's a high profile position in the world of football. And I was thinking about the other managers that have jobs like that. And two words stood out to me: arrogance and aggression. And I didn't know if Graham Potter had the same levels of arrogance and aggression that people like Klopp and Guardiola and Conte do. And I thought immediately about Mauricio Pochettino's relative failures, if you like, going to Paris Saint-Germain. And I always felt, well, he's almost too nice to cope with the level of egos in that Paris Saint-Germain squad. And this is a weird question to ask, but I do feel like Graham Potter might be currently too nice. That first press conference, all I want to see is stick your chest out, right? Be as confident as possible in explaining your own abilities and what you're going to bring to this job, because the PR machine works for other coaches in ways it hasn't yet worked for Graham Potter, right? That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying he's not a good enough coach, but it's a perception. I talk about football being about perception a lot, and I think it may hinder him, especially in the early stages at Chelsea. That's all I want to say. Yeah. He did the right thing and grown a beard. He changed his image, right? He changed his image a little bit. He got a little bit more grown up, right? a little bit more mature. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if he's going to be a suit manager, whether he's just going to go for the old merino, whether he's going to get the stripes on the sleeve like Scott Parker. I don't know what he's going to do, but he needs to do something here, doesn't he?
So do you think he needs both arrogance and aggression?
I do, I do. Yeah, I do. I think you need both. And I don't mean that, by the way, in a bad way. What I mean is, when I say aggression, what I mean is, they are very confident that my way works.
Yeah.
If I get sacked playing my way,
I'm not sure about arrogance.
Yeah, exactly. I think what he's self-assured, and he doesn't have to change who he is. What he might have to find is a ruthlessness, because there might be people who don't get aboard his bus, and he might have to bomb them.
See, Jose,
and that's something that'll be different. So we don't know. Maybe he has shown that. I mean, he cast aside Neil Mopai sometimes when he could have for fairly small misdemeanors. That's the only thing off the top of our head. We don't know what goes on behind the scenes, and I'm sure a lot of his stuff is about bringing the collective together, being a good guy, basically.
Yeah.
I agree. That's one thing I agree with you, is he might have to find a ruthless edge.
But I think the difference is, when you're a manager and you're selling your project, and in the jobs that he's done so far, it has been about getting somewhere. And it's been about an upward trajectory, and he's been on an upward trajectory as a coach, and his players have been, and the clubs that he's coached have been. He's going to Chelsea. The players in that squad are staying at the top. They know that. The club itself is staying at the top. They know that. There is no upward trajectory journey. It's win trophies or you leave. So the only thing you can sell to the players there is, we're winning trophies. He hasn't won any. So that's what I mean about that level of almost arrogance.
Arrogance can be a dangerous thing when you haven't won anything.
But I mean arrogance in the best possible sense.
Yeah, okay.
Knowing yourself and being truly confident in the role.
It may be then about that. It becomes about how we do it. It might be about the way they do it. That might be the sell. It might be like, you know, I think I would say that Pep Guardiola will always talk about the way that, you know, pass the ball, more passes. Mm. You know, it's about the way Manchester City do it. It's not just about winning trophies. They want to win trophies, and he thinks that's the best way of doing it. But a lot of it is about our play. He talks about the way we play a lot of the time. That could be the thing, because Chelsea haven't really had that. They've won trophies. They've had some, you know, enormous successes, but it's been about doing it no matter how you do it. Now it might be about the way they do it.
We haven't even mentioned poor old Brighton. Where are they left with, eh? No manager.
And Billy Gilmore.
Oh, yeah, cool. The only thing that I would say about Brighton is... I heard an interview, and I'm sure it was on a fantastic radio station called TalkSport, with their ownership group about their future planning around Graham Potter, but also other elements of the club. And they basically said, we've always got a plan. And with him, we kind of know we're going to lose him soon enough. Like, someone will soon come in for him in a job that we know will be irresistible for him. And they said, we constantly review who our first, second and third choice will be based on what other managerial changes are currently taking place, but also the stock of other managers. So the main targets, they say, will always be realistic. And they were bringing people who they've already done their due diligence on character, on commitment to the role and on style of football that they believe will be a pretty seamless transition. So I'm intrigued to know who they appoint, but whoever it is, and it might be a name that we've never heard of, I believe that they will get a coach in who will take them forward. Because I think listen, I tweeted it yesterday. I think Graham Potter, and I said it at the time, he's been at one of the most stable clubs in European football. You know, the trust that they have in him, the support that they give to him, the realistic way in which they view the world of football. To move to Chelsea, you know, for me, I almost said he needs assurances from Chelsea that they are going to be a stable club going forward. I've got more faith that Brighton will be okay after this than Graham Potter moving to Chelsea. That's all I would say.
I'd agree.
So we will see. We will see what happens. But congratulations to Graham Potter. You know, it might just be, look, as I've said before, what?
Is it happened?
It's going to happen.
Okay.
I've just read the Times app, Gregor. I have just read the Times app, which says Graham Potter is just about to agree to become the new Chelsea boss. So can I not congratulate the guy?
Of course you can.
Okay. All right. Congratulations to Graham Potter. If you're listening to this and Mauricio Pochettino is the new Chelsea boss, you might as well skip to the next episode. All right. Okay. Listen, plenty more still to come. We'll be looking back at the big week in the Champions League. Of course, we will. The start of the WSL is on the horizon. We'll also look ahead to a huge game in the Premier League this weekend. Stay with us on The Game.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the Champions League this week, Liverpool's relative woes continued with a 4-1 hammering in Napoli. The Reds were 3-0 down at halftime. The performance underlined, I think, a very different Liverpool this season to the one that we have come to expect. Jurgen Klopp says they need to reinvent themselves. We're going to come to what that might be in a few moments' time. But Tony, what is the problem for you with Liverpool right now?
Wow, that's an incredibly difficult question to answer, because what I witnessed last night was pretty extraordinary. And it's a bit of Groundhog Day, as Liverpool have fallen behind very early in the game. Mistakes, littered with mistakes. I mean, individuals. I mean, there was one thing that really bothered me in the game. Liverpool went 1-0 down. I think it's about the 20th minute mark. And Trent has got himself on the edge of the 18-yard box. A midfielder's got the ball. And I see Trent literally in the centre forwards position. Now he's the right back. Now, there's mistakes that you're doing in the game, individual ones, where you give away the ball or you're out of position, I get. But Trent Alexander, as we know, is an attacking fullback. But you cannot be centre-forward in this moment. Now, Joe Gomez, so many mistakes. His worst game in the country, mile for Liverpool. You know, take alongside Van Dijk's this season. This season has been very, very poor so far from him. The one that gets me, because I think he's one of Liverpool's greatest ever players, is Andy Robertson. I'm seeing him make mistakes, and he never. I mean, whether you could argue he played way too much football last year, and he sort of feels like he's not quite on his game, and he's been substituted quite a few times for Liverpool in recent weeks in their Premier League matches, and it feels like 90% of the team, apart from Diaz and probably Alisson, are playing to their normal standard or are slightly better. You go to the other areas of the pitch and Mo has just not got going. Not. I mean, his touch has got away from him. I'm seeing things that I would have never imagined Liverpool players are doing. And there's not one or two, there's six or seven. And that is the problem.
Is there an explanation for it, Gregor?
It's very hard to explain it because they have been at such a high level for such a long time. And that in itself could be the explanation. It's like everything good must come to an end. And I don't know. I think we're maybe slightly too soon to be saying that. But it's getting pretty worrying. And that, you know, that Joe Gomez was like, he just wanted them to be put out of his misery. There was the little one too. He just like, he looked like he was sapped of all energy. He just didn't want to. He knew he had to make the run to follow the 1-2, and he just didn't have the energy to do it. And then, you know, so there are individuals like that, and then it can kind of spread as well. That's the truth. When you don't have the confidence in the people around you, then it sort of it alters the way that you play. So the other thing is quickly is the number of times that Liverpool are just being played through with one ball now. And you know, we've spoken a lot about their high defensive line, and you need. You know, we saw when Van Dijk was injured and missing for such a long period of time that really affected them in itself. And now that Van Dijk is not playing at that level, his peak level, perhaps not maybe even like half a yard slower than he was, they're being caught out. They're being caught out by simple balls through now. So like that's a major concern, because they either need to change the way they're playing, or I don't know what the other answer is, because if you don't have it, you rely on individuals to be really on the ball at the top of their game and athletic enough to cover to chase players in behind and to be able to cover and to be quick enough. So you know, Konate's injured, Matip's always been slightly questionable, and Van Dijk is not the imperious figure that we've seen for so long. So I think they need to look to change that, to be honest.
I wanted to ask Gregor this problem that I see, and you talked about there, you just touched on the one ball that can literally open up Liverpool. Now, what do you do with Trent? If Trent, we always know he's an attacking fullback or wingback. We know that he loves to get forward. But isn't there a time that it's so irresponsible that he's getting in areas that it completely ruins the setup of the team, the shape of the team? Because Trent was playing everywhere and nowhere. You know, so many times this season down the left side, and Liverpool fans will tell you that, you know, Trent has been caught at the far post by Mitrovic at the start of the season, and other opportunities have been created. But last night, Trent felt like he would play where I want to play and no more. I mean, I'm watching the game and thinking, Trent, and Klopp hasn't sort of gone, I'm taking you off. You can't be where you are. I know you're attack-minded. I know you want to be creative and be adventurous in the forward line. But honestly, watching Trent last night, and I love him as a footballer, but you cannot be that irresponsible.
The only thing I'll say is that we don't know what his instructions are, because one thing from watching, actually, that struck me in the Premier League in the opening weeks of the season is the number of fullbacks that are playing very differently now, and that they're forming sort of overloads and rotations with midfielders and wide players. Arsenal, we've spoken about Zinchenko. Even Manchester United's goal against Southampton came from a similar sort of move, where Dalot had moved into the forward line almost, and then Sancho had gone in field, Alanga came out wide, and they combined and he got the cross in. So, you know, that seems to be a feature of fullbacks play these days. So Trent Alexander-Arnold, we know, can be such a threat in attacking sense. I just come back to the same thing again. You then need proper elite defenders at the top of their game who are able to cover and do the job on their own almost. We've said this so many times before. If you're a Liverpool centre-half, you basically need to be like as good a 1v1 defender and as good an athlete as there is in European football. And the problem is they don't have any defenders that look like that at the moment.
Molly, what do you think their issue is?
I think just looking at the starting midfield for me last night, you've got Harvey Elliott, who is obviously a fantastically talented player, but he's young and he can't be expected to be the best player on the pitch every week. You're not going to get that from a young player still developing. You've got Fabinho, who obviously has been fantastic for Liverpool, so we'll let him off. But James Milner is 36 and is starting for Liverpool in the Champions League. And I think it's obviously not his fault that Liverpool, for all of their fantastic recruitment, have seemingly recruited a huge amount of injury-prone midfielders. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, who you'd be forgiven for forgetting, was actually still a Liverpool player. Thiago even has struggled with injury since he's been at the club. Obviously, Naby Keita, another one that it almost feels like he's been injured more than he has played. And I think that's the problem, really, when you do have such, as you guys have just mentioned, when you do have such a focus on the defence, they need that real comfortable midfield in front of them. And I think that's where they've really struggled to kind of, how many times do we say in football that you need to get hold of a game in midfield? And that midfield never did last night. And I think that is an area that is actually exposing Liverpool more and their defence. For example, if you've got a good midfield that should know that Trent likes to make those runs forward, you have somebody that covers more, whereas quite often recently it's felt like there's just no one there. And I think, you know, Fabinho has been fantastic, but he can't do it all on his own. And I think really maybe they should have strengthened more in that area. It was all just a bit predictable. When you look at that, is that starting midfield three good enough to be a Champions League contender? No. And I know that there's players that are injured, but they're players that you'd almost expect to be injured at this point because they've been injured so often. And they brought in Artur, obviously, in the transfer window, but and he came on for Elliot last night. But, you know, is he a big enough signing? Should they have gone all out for a really big midfielder and maybe got rid of some of those players that are quite injury prone? I think for me, that's just causing more focus on the defence, who quite clearly last night had a pretty poor evening, but they weren't helped by what was in front of them.
One other thing that struck me watching this last night was that, you know, for a long period of time we've spoken about Liverpool's front three and the kind of need to regenerate it, and then they were kind of caught on the back foot by Sadio Mane's departure, and Firmino just doesn't look like anything like the player he was, and Salah. Yeah, look, I think we still expect Salah to hit heights again. We spoke for so long about how they've actually prepared well for this, you know, bringing Luis Diaz. Jota has been a hit, generally speaking. Yes, he's missed games with injury. And Darwin coming in, we expect him to be a success. But I think just kind of it's hit home again how remarkable that front three were and how really it's going to be almost impossible, I think, to replace their output. And in both regards, so it's not just in terms of the goals, and it's the way that they press from the front as well. I think it's just the way Liverpool play, it is quite a kind of finely tuned system. They need, if there's not pressure from the front, then it exposes the back even more. So I just think that we will slowly come to realise how remarkable that front three were, and I don't think whatever Liverpool do to replace it, it's going to be quite the same, to be honest.
Tony, finally, on this, Jurgen Klopp says they need to reinvent themselves. What would you do?
Well, reinventing himself, look, it can't be that dramatic. He believes in his style and he's been very successful in having an attack-minded side that would always try and hurt you and try and win games. He believes in the way he plays. Reinventing himself, I think he would really means tweaking slightly Liverpool. Not so much because... And Molly touched on the midfield. The midfield has been decimated. And, you know, Curtis Jones hasn't kicked on as well, if you want to add another midfielder in there. When Mane went to Bayern Munich, I so wanted, and I'm not trying to be smart in the hindsight, but I so wanted Liverpool to try and buy Josh Kimmich and use Mane as a bit of a, you know, broker in the deal and go, because Josh Kimmich is exactly what they need in midfield. Someone who can control the game like a centre of the squash court and add... I was... lost when I got a little bit upset when they let Wijnaldum go. And I know it didn't pan out well for PSG, but when they had Wijnaldum, Henderson at his best, Fabinho and Thiago. Look, Thiago's a huge loss anyway, because the one person who's never going to give it away easily is him. And they really have missed him. But there is a lot wrong at the moment. You know, we've talked about defence, midfield and forward line. How bad can it be if you're talking about all three? At least the goalkeepers. Well, exactly. So how bad is it? You know, it's dreadful at the minute. And reinventing himself, going back to your point, Hugh, I think he's just has to tweak it slightly and hope players, because whatever we say in all of this, players are making mistakes we can't even recognise when you're watching Liverpool.
Yeah, OK. All right, well, listen, Jurgen Klopp does have to find an answer to that. Elsewhere in the Champions League this week, though, listen, I've got a Scottish football correspondent for the day in Gregor Robertson. I've got a former Celtic striker with me. So let's just very, very quickly touch on those two teams from the old firm. Celtic just showed, I think, the fine margins of a club like Celtic in the Champions League, a night like any night at Celtic Park. It can go their way. If they don't take their chances, though, it can just go the other. And really, they could have been 3-0 up, and they ended up 3-0 down against Real Madrid. It was just one of those nights. It could have been one of the best nights ever, and it just wouldn't go in the back of the net, and then they got hurt. And it was one of those, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, they were. Look, the first half, they were outstanding. They, you know, created some brilliant chances, really kind of on the front foot. And that's what we expected from Postecoglou's team. It's there's only one way to play. There's only one way to approach it. And you know, actually, after the game, you've got some confidence in the way that, you know, that they'll be able to at least take the game to the other opponents in the group. It's just that Real Madrid are the kings of Europe, and they demonstrated why.
You reminded me, by the way, who I thought, this is a while ago, who I predicted would replace Graham Potter at Brighton and Postecoglou.
I think he's going to start to be in the running for Premier League jobs, absolutely. I'd be very sad if he didn't want to see through the Champions League campaign at least. And you know, he's done a remarkable job. So absolutely, I think he will be in the reckoning soon. As will some of Celtic's players, to be honest. You know, I love watching Hatate play. He's just like a little kind of little maverick, little schemer. And Jota as well. That little that switch play in first time for a chance in the first half was majestic. So there was some really good play, absolutely. But then it was just, as we said, it felt eminently predictable what was coming in the second half, and it did.
Rangers beaten 4-0 for the second time in a matter of days. They're outclassed by Ajax after that old firm thrashing at the weekend as well. Would you have any concerns for their side at the moment?
Obviously, they lost the old firm game 4-0 as well, and Celtic are in another level from Rangers at the moment. That's quite clear. Ajax have let go so many players. You know, they sell players on, they move, but the conveyor belt just continues. And I wasn't surprised they got beat. 4-0, it's been a dreadful last week, 10 days for Rangers Football Club after the success of getting to the Champions League group stages. And just one thing, can I just mention one thing on the Celtic and the Rangers Real Madrid game? I thought it was really interesting. It's the worst thing for Celtic is that, yes, they had their chance and they didn't take them, but they're playing against the team, certainly the best in Europe about managing games. And they do that brilliantly, Real Madrid. And that's when you talk about different levels of why, okay, we've suffered, you haven't taken your chances, then we punish you. That's Real Madrid in a nutshell. That's why they're European champions.
Even then, though, you kind of watch them sometimes and think, well, hang on, this is a spell where you're not managing the game that well, and they still don't seem to concede a goal.
Yeah, that's
it's been remarkable in the last few years.
Last year.
Courtois pop up with a wonder save. Mm. Something happens. They just have like an aura about them, don't they? And yeah. And then, you know, Modric just kind of pulls the strings and scores another goal in Scotland with the outside of his right foot.
Mm. See, 36 or 37?
Modric. Something like that, yeah. But what I did see from that game, and I think I expect it at Ibrox as well, it will be a different prospect playing Rangers at home in the Champions League.
Absolutely.
And it is a very difficult prospect going to Glasgow to play Celtic in the Champions League as well.
Absolutely. I mean, watching the kind of scenes before kickoff, the, you know, the billowing smoke from the flares, it looked like an atmosphere in Turkey or something.
Yeah,
it was like, you know what I mean? That kind of really rich European heritage. It's absolutely, you know, and you saw Modric tweeting about after saying this, that was a special atmosphere. It is pretty special, and it's the same at Ibrox. It's raucous. It really does kind of rock you to your core. So that's where Celtic and Rangers will need to get points if they're going to have any chance.
Okay, but no concerns, Gregor, for Rangers at the moment under Van Bronckhorst?
Well, what they need to do is actually get back on track now in the SVFL, and I think they've got Aberdeen next, which is not going to be an easy game, and they need to kind of make sure it's not going to be a mini crisis. Look, I wouldn't say there's concern. I was surprised, you know, Tony said once. I was surprised because Rangers' record in Europe has been remarkable, and this was something different. They weren't at it in the first half in particular, and that's what I mean. They just need to get back on track now before the next Champions League game comes around.
Okay, we'll discuss Spurs and Manchester City in the Champions League at the end of the podcast because they meet in the Premier League this weekend. So stay tuned for that. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, just hit subscribe. The Women's Super League, the WSL, returns this weekend, and it's expected to be a pretty big season. Plenty of bums on seats after the special summer for the Lionesses, of course, who are also into the World Cup with minimal fuss. Molly Hudson, I know you've been following England this week, but now it's time to quickly turn your attention to the WSL, and there are some big stories to talk about. We're going to start with Manchester City. Ciara Walsh off to Barcelona, but there has been a bit of an exodus at the club as well. So before we actually talk about the league season, what's going on at City right now?
I think there's a lot of departures in isolation that make lots of sense and wouldn't be cause for concern. But unfortunately for Manchester City, they've all happened in a very short space of time. If you take Jill Scott, who is obviously retired, Ellen White, retired, Lucy Bronze, moved to Barcelona, Ciara Walsh has obviously gone with her, who I'll touch on in a second. Georgia Stanway has gone to Bayern Munich. Caroline Weir has gone to Real Madrid. I mean, just listing those players, apart from Jill Scott, they were all starters. And I think that's the real struggle when you have a 22-game season in the Women's Super League. It's very short. And, for example, Arsenal only lost once all season last campaign and finished 1 point behind Chelsea and missed out on the title. And I think where you've maybe got a little bit more time in, for example, the Premier League to bed in new players, you really, really don't have that in the Women's Super League. And I think that midfield area is a particular cause of concern for City because Stanway, Weir and Walsh made up that starting midfield and all three have gone. I think there were several bids rejected from Barcelona, and Ciara Walsh has now gone officially for a world record fee around the 400,000 mark, which I think in the end City felt like they couldn't turn that down. But it's that old sort of, yes, they've got that money and that's fantastic, and you know, from my point of view, Ciara Walsh completely deserves that. I think she's right up there with the best midfielders in the world. But it's all well and good having that money, but where do you find a player that replaces Ciara Walsh or even replaces some of those other midfield departures in a day, essentially? You have to think that they planned in some circumstance. They must have kind of decided internally, if Barcelona offer a certain figure, then we'll let her go. But you know, they've got, today is transfer deadline day. So they've got very limited time. I think I understand that Yui Hasegawa is going to come in from West Ham, who is a very good midfielder, but I just think they've just lost so many. But the caveat to all that is, how can you blame somebody like Ciara Walsh, who is one of the very best in the world, from going to play at Barcelona, who will probably win the Spanish League again quite comfortably, will be right up there for winning the Champions League, when Manchester City, for the second year in a row, lost in pre-qualifying to Real Madrid? You're not going to keep the best players in the world if you don't have serious Champions League ambitions. And unfortunately for City, they've been very unlucky in getting Real Madrid both years. And I just think, in that respect, you can't blame the players. And is it a crisis? It probably is, but it's also a crisis of circumstance in a way, in terms of the reasons these players have left. And also, it's the perfect storm, really, with the start of the season on this weekend, and they're playing Arsenal on Sunday. So I think they're going to struggle in the early weeks. They've brought some decent players in, but just to get all of that to gel in a very short turnaround, because that pre-qualifying meant We spoke to Alex Greenwood while we were in Austria with England, and she said that they literally hadn't had time off. They'd had like 5 days since the Euros because they were back in for pre-qualifying. So all of that is working against Manchester City. And I think at some point, a club of that size, that they will be looking at that manager's role and thinking, is Gareth Taylor the right person to take us forward, knowing that they need to win Silverware?
It's a big first weekend. You mentioned the game between Manchester City and Arsenal. Chelsea faced West Ham. Spurs against Man United. Host of great fixtures. Check them out. Get to your local game if you can. Most of the games taking place on Sunday, in fact. So, you know, get down there. But I do have to say, when it comes to Arsenal and Chelsea, the two teams that vied for the title last year, do we see a repeat of not only the fact that it'll be these two teams going for the title, but the same levels of quality? Do you expect that this season, Molly?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is, and I appreciate this may age very badly because the ball hasn't been kicked yet, but I do think it is a two-horse race for the title again. I think the Champions League race will be fantastic, actually, between Manchester United and Manchester City, given what we've just talked about. I think Manchester United have a decent chance of qualifying for the Champions League for the first time. But I think in terms of that title, Chelsea have made moves in the transfer window. Particularly for me, I'm really, really excited to see Khadisha Buchanan in the Women's Super League. Was fantastic for Lyon for so many years. Has that real winning mentality, that experience. And I suppose if you could pick an area of Chelsea that has been a weakness, it has been their defence. And Emma Hayes has really gone out into the transfer market and strengthened that. So they'll look to push on. But I also think Arsenal, having made a much more low-key transfer window, they've brought in Lena Hurtig to give some more options in the front line, but they've been quite stable. And sometimes that's in real comparison to Manchester City. Sometimes it's good to have that stability. It's Jonas Eidevall's second season. They're a lot more used to what he expects, the style of play now. And I think they're a lot more aware of just how important it is not to drop points unnecessarily. As I say, they only lost one game last season. So I think it will be, you'd have Chelsea as favourites again for me, but I think it will be another one that goes right down to the wire.
And just finally, huge season for women's football in the country. Of course, we're building up to the World Cup. We want to keep all eyes on women's football after the success of the Euros as well. But the WSL is now going to play a big part week to week. Do you think it will capitalise on the great summer that we've had?
There's been a huge uptake in season tickets right across the league. I mean, a club like Aston Villa, who doesn't even have any Lionesses, is, you know, 200% up on their season tickets. Clubs like Brighton doing really good work. So I think in terms of the initial impact, I think it will be quite sizeable. Manchester City Arsenal that we mentioned on Sunday is sold out, which should be a new record at the City Football Academy. That's a 7,000 capacity. Arsenal women have sold 40,000 tickets for the North London Derby towards the end of the month at the Emirates, which would be a new record for the division in terms of attendance. So I think the early signs are that it is actually making a difference in a way that it hasn't before. It's always been very boom and bust. England have always, even going back to the 2015 World Cup, then 2019, there has been an impact from the international team, but it's died off very quickly. Whereas this time it does feel as though perhaps because it was a home tournament and obviously England went and won it, they did as much as they possibly could. I think it will have a real impact this time around. And now it's just making sure that translates right across the season. And then, as you say, the World Cup is in the summer. So, you know, time to go and win another trophy and make another kind of another statement, I suppose.
Yeah, okay, all right. We're already thinking about lifting the World Cup. Why not? You've got a dream, right? It's going to be a great season in the WSL. Make sure you follow all of Molly Hudson's writing on the Times app. We're going to turn our attention back to the Premier League next, so don't go anywhere. Two sides with routine wins in the Champions League in midweek are up next. Let's speak about Spurs first. Richarlison with his first goals for the club in their 2-0 win over Marseille. Erling Haaland got another two goals for Manchester City in their 4-0 win in Seville. But they meet in the Premier League this weekend at the Etihad. And Spurs will be confident, their fans and their players, after winning both home and away against Pep Guardiola's side last season. So, Tony, should City be concerned about the visit of Spurs this weekend?
Absolutely. You touched on last year, but if you look at their records this year, both 4 wins, both 2 draws, both on 14 points, 5:30 kickoff on Saturday night. Spurs will have an idea, and their idea will always be the same. They'll try and break the lines and try and get in behind with them. Kane does this role better than anybody else, where he just drops into the space, sort of in the middle of the pitch. If he gets on the ball, he turns. He then looks to play a through ball between the centre-half and the full-back areas. And that has worked brilliantly for them. So it'll be more about what Pep Guardiola will do to try and counter it, which has worked against them. Because Spurs have done that really well against City. Done it at the start of last season and then obviously done it mid-season. So I think it's a really intriguing game because there is something very different about Spurs' team this year. They've got off to a good start. They look like a side that are going to be, you know, what they conceded 5, I think, this year so far. So we know Conte's team are always really good defensively. So, yeah, it's a huge test, especially after, you know, Champions League week. And I think calling this one is tough because Haaland and City are just looking like an absolute machine. But this will be a very, very close game.
Yeah, no, Tony, I think Tony's absolutely right. Is that's the, you know, the chink in Manchester City's armour is the counter-attack. And this is a Spurs team set up to be ruthless in that approach. I want to see them kind of showing the same bite as well. Acting like they are competing with them, not just in this one game, but, you know, they want to go toe-to-toe for the rest of the season. I expect it to be a tight game. I think Tony's right about, you know, Haaland has been ridiculous. It's pretty scary. But the way that James Gearbrand actually wrote a really good piece about this in the last few days, the way that Tottenham are condensing the middle of the pitch in particular, where they've got the back three and the two kind of holding midfielders, they are one of the best for reducing the quality of shots that the opponents get off against them, basically. Since Conte's come, I think Spurs have gone to the top of the table, basically, for the quality of shots they face. And so they're reducing the number of good chances that the opposition get, and that's, you know, they've not been in scintillating form by any stretch. That bodes well. If they're strong defensively, then they've got enough quality. They've got more than enough quality on that counter to score goals.
Yeah, that 2-2 draw at Chelsea where they were really poor and Chelsea didn't punish them. And OK, there was some big decisions that went against Chelsea on the day, but they still showed a resilience that has to be there for them to have any chance of not only Champions League football, but trying to challenge for the title.
Molly, would you make any tweaks to that Spurs side going away to Manchester City?
I think it's quite interesting that we talked about that Liverpool front three earlier on, but we're very used to having a settled kind of Tottenham front three. And I think Richarlison has come in and really mixed that up. I think it'll be very interesting to see now with the transfer activity that Tottenham have made this summer. There's now, I think, probably 2 key positions that I would look at going into this game. Who comes in? Because for me, I think Richarlison's got to start. Who comes out? Is it Son or is it Kulusevski? And then also the wing-back position with Perisic and Sessegnon is a really interesting debate. Obviously, one very much at the start of their career and one coming to the end of their career, but both offer very different things. And I think it will be interesting to see what Conte does in those decisions. For me, I think, and this is not something that has been said very often in the past few years, but I think you might have to drop Son if it was me making that decision. I think Conte may very well not do that and think, you know, it's a big game. You rely on your big players to step up in those moments and perform. But I think Kulusevski just offers something really different for that Tottenham front three. He's a little bit more physical and I've been really impressed with him since he came into the English game. I think that will maybe make a big difference as to how that balance works with Richarlison going forward, because I think what he's done off the bench and what he did in the Champions League in midweek kind of makes him the one that you have to include in a way, obviously, alongside Harry Kane. So I think those decisions could make a big difference, how Conte really gets the best out of that squad depth that he has now, because against City, you know, when you get those chances, you've got to take them. And can you risk having a player in Son who is out of form and quite low in confidence at the moment?
It's a huge call, isn't it? I'd probably stick with Son just because of the relationship with Kane. But I know Richarlison would, you know, get a good half an hour in this game if I was Antonio Conte. Sessegnon is who I'd probably start at left wing back for the counter-attacking speed and the left-footed balance. But I do think you need to keep them interested on that right-hand side, particularly the right full-back of Manchester City, whoever does start in that area, because I think that they can punish you there as well. And it's important on the counter to just press Manchester City back as much as you can. But I do think this Tottenham side is just turning into an Antonio Conte team. They're very much now built in his image, which means there is a role for Richarlison. Just a little bit of S-housery away from home as well. Get the fans going, get everyone in a bad mood. And then, you know, he'll sneak in with a little back post header, won't he? And he'll just do the celebration. The Tottenham fans will love it. And that'll be a perfect win. But I do think they need, I almost feel like they do need to win, because the Chelsea game, they sent a message to the rest of the league. And we spoke about what message would they send in that game. Well, they sent a message that they're good, but not great. And if they go to, and I know they've won away at City before, but they could send a message this weekend with a win that they are truly, you know, whether they're playing well or not, you've got to take Tottenham seriously in terms of the title race. If they can win away this season, I think that does change the mindset massively.
You do love, I feel this with Conte. He loves to have a player that's going to rock the boat. You know, like Richarlison, who's going to unsettle other players and put pressure on their place. The big point I would say, if you stop Kevin De Bruyne, and which is a very difficult thing to do, and if you're having two holding midfielders, make sure that he doesn't get on the ball that often. I think that's a big weapon in stopping City, because he's the one, for me, that always will find Haaland. He's done this with numerous players, hasn't he? He's done it with Sterling and Aguero in the past. But if you can stop him dominating the play in the middle of midfield, it gives you a great chance of getting a result.
Quick predictions then, Gregor?
Narrow City win.
Tony?
Haaland, two goals again. Sorry, I would have said three. City win, yeah.
Molly?
Tony has stolen my line there. It's definitely going to be a City win, and it's going to be Haaland, isn't it?
It's an easy prediction. It's open goal every week now, isn't it?
I think this one's going to be tight, and I think it might be a draw. Another entertaining one. I'm going to go 2-2, I think. Yeah. So we'll see. We will discuss that on Monday. Of course, we will. The big game in the Premier League and all the other stories to boot. Thank you so much, Gregor Robertson, Tony Cascarino, Molly Hudson, and Tom Roddy. And to all of you for listening, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast wherever you're listening. And also make sure you check out a Times subscription right now, thetimes.co.uk/the game, or download the Times app. We'll see you on Monday.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.